Right. Let's start on that. So, a French volunteer today to give a talk on, or to do a discussion on the Galaxy Halo collection, is that?
Yep.
Did I get that right?
So this is a little bit off topic, but it's something that I work on, and that's why I decided to fill your time with this discussion. So I'm going to talk about the Galaxy Halo connection, and if you want to know more about this, this basically was the topic of KATP exactly a year ago here. So you can find a lot of talks on this topic on the KATP website, and there's an excellent review paper that just recently came out by Wexler and Tinker, 2018. For those of you who want more information, you can find it there. So what the Galaxy Halo connection is about is to try and establish the Galaxy Halo connection, which in a very general way you can think of as a conditional probability function. It says, given a bunch of Halo properties, what is the probability that a Halo with those properties hosts a galaxy with properties G1, G2, G3, whatever? Okay. This is in all generality. This is what you really would like to know. This is like, this is the outcome of galaxy formation in the Lambda CDM universe. And this is very complicated in general, but you can make it a little bit simpler and start by sort of the first order simple thing you can do is ask, what is the probability that a halo of a given mass, MH, hosts a galaxy of a given stellar mass, M star? Okay. And the goal of galaxy halo connection work is to try and constrain this. Now, there's two different approaches that you may take towards this. Okay. The first approach is to say, well, let's start from the real initial conditions of the universe. Okay. So there's a linear density field. And we know that pretty much. Okay. We know that, you just read it off from the cosmic microwave background. Those are the initial conditions. And all we need to do is we add baryonic, let's call it baryonic physics, to describe how the gas cools, how the stars form out of that gas, how feedback works, how the radiation, magnetic fields. In principle, if you add enough physics here, and then you propagate it forward, either in a hydrodynamic simulation, or you write down a bunch of differential equations that describe these processes, you can, in principle, go ahead and make predictions of observables like the stellar mass function, the abundance of galaxies function of stellar mass, of things like the correlation function. Okay? Xi of R is the correlation function that describes a clustering of galaxies, S function of stellar mass. And you can test these against data. So that is sort of what hydrodynamic simulations do. Okay? These people are going to talk about it tomorrow, and they'll tell you that it's really hard. Okay. You can also say, to hell with physics. I'm going to sidestep this. And we're going to start with the nonlinear initial conditions, the nonlinear density field, which basically means the distribution of dark matter halos. Okay? Because in the nonlinear present-day field, density field, the dark matter at least is clumped in dark matter halos. And from simulations, we have a good idea about how they're distributed. We know what an individual halo looks like, so let's start with that. And then all we do is we model this parameter, this quantity. Okay, that's a model. And I'll describe the kind of models you can use there. And once I know this, the halos and how they're distributed, and I make an assumption about this, I can also make the same predictions. Compare them to observations. And then you're data-driven, and you say, I just use a Bayes engine to infer what the best fit relation is, and try to constrain this thing. Okay. And that's halo occupation modeling. And the cool thing about it, it sort of sidesteps all this, and says, this is actually a way to marginalize over all the uncertainty in galaxy formation. If we can do this for any cosmology, we can just marginalize over all of galaxy formation physics, just see, can you come up at all with a realistic realization that fits all the data? And that's not guaranteed to work for any cosmology, for every cosmology. Okay? So you may actually hope to do cosmology that way, and I'll briefly touch on that. So then the question is...
when would it fail?
So I'll give examples on that a little bit. Okay. But, where was it going? Model, next I'm going to talk about, the different kind of models. So what kind of models do you use here? And again, there's basically two different camps, different ideas. One is what I call subhalo based. And the idea there is that, if you have a halo, you have all these subhalos, or zooming around in a halo, okay, you can go in the numerical simulation. The idea is that you're going to say, every halo and host halo hosts a galaxy, and I'm going to come up with a characterization of a parameterization of the relation between the stellar mass of that galaxy and the properties like the halo mass or the maximum velocity of that subhalo and host halo. So you're bounded now by the number of galaxies in a halo, in a big halo, is set by however many subhalos you find in your numerical simulation. The radial profile of those galaxies is set by whatever the radial profile of the subhalos. But, for those of you who were around last week, I argued, you can't trust those things. Okay? At least I don't trust them. And if you add baryons in your simulation, the number of these subhalos changes quite dramatically. The radial profile of the subhalos can change quite dramatically. So now you're doing something here that is still dependent on all this baryonic stuff that's going on. And we wanted to sort of marginalize over it. So I say, no, don't do that. There's sort of sometimes one method that is used within this framework. It's what is called sham subhalo abundance matching. You just abundance match on these things. But I think a better thing to do is a host halo based one. One thing that we believe to be able to predict quite accurately is the halo mass function, okay, of host halos. So now you ignore subhalos and you just allow as many galaxies in here as you want. So the number of galaxies itself is free. The radial profile of those galaxies is free. Those are both part of your model. Okay, that's really in the spirit of the halo occupation modeling, allowing you to marginalize over all uncertainties. Yes?
At high mass, aren't these close to identical? Like, there's some mass where you don't have some more, so in other words, don't I get to a point where the sham and the host halo kind of based approaches, like, where
you're... Oh, if you look only, you would only look at the most massive galaxies in the universe, you mean?
When you're only at the one halo, like the one galaxy per halo threshold, aren't they the same?
Well, but the one gap, this cluster has many.
It's because the subhalos are dark at some point once you go to low enough masses.
Oh, if it's very low masses.
Well, yeah, there's some limit in which these are not different because you're either only hosting one galaxy or zero galaxies, and so...
Okay, yeah, at the very low mass end, that's a good point. There you expect the host, but there, that, as I will argue, that's the mass limit where we, at the moment, still know very little with this method. Doesn't really get you very far so far because of lack of data, basically.
It depends also on the question you're asking. If you really want only the mass function, stellar mass function, then the host halo is enough because, at a given mass, at a given mass of a galaxy, most of them are actually host halo based and not subhalo, so for a bigger object, right? Because the mass function is so steep.
That's what I was thinking.
But if you want, first of all, to get the details of the clustering, then that makes a big difference, right? Because the ones that are, otherwise you don't get it.
And again, just to give you an idea, right? If you really, in this spirit of trying to not be biased, not put any priors on this here, one model is all the galaxies in the universe live in one halo. If I just want to put this halo mass function, you can clearly see this does not put any constraint whatsoever on this thing. Unless I'm willing to accept a prior, like one galaxy per halo or that something. But that's a prior. And in principle, you want to leave things as free as possible. So under this host halo-based modeling, there's basically, it's called the halo occupation distribution models, which what they do is they say, what I'm going to model effectively is the number of galaxies, and that's always the number of galaxies more massive than some limit, okay, and a given halo mass, function of halo mass. And they come up with a functional form for this, and that's where they fit the data.
So what exactly do you mean when talking about the mass function?
The mass function, this M is the halo mass, so in that case.
So the number of halos for every...
per co-moving volume in the universe.
Per decade of mass.
So it's literally the distribution function of halo masses in the universe.
As a function of
mass, so the
number.
Yeah, the probability of the number.
Yeah,
exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Then we can just draw
it. So you have, so if you plot log, let's do this for stellar mass, for galaxies, okay, and then here you plot dn, dl and m star, that's the number per logarithmic being instead of mass, and typically it looks something like this. This power law. If many more low mass galaxies, massive galaxies, and then there is a maximum scale below which it exponentially cuts off. And the halo mass function looks basically very similar. Okay. So another way to do this is what is called the CLF, which is sometimes the conditional luminosity function, or in this case the conditional stellar mass function, because I'm working with stellar mass now. And what that models is this thing, it says, given a halo of that mass, how many galaxies of this stellar mass are such a halo host? And these two things are basically just the same, right? I can just integrate the conditional stellar mass function over stellar mass from whatever stellar mass limit that this n corresponds to. Right? So these are just the same. One is a differential of the other one.
Wait, what is now the difference between this phi and the p that you want to get at in the end?
What is the difference between... Oh, this is... They're not exactly the same. Because this thing is not normalized. And this is just a total number, and this is a probability. But if I would basically normalize this thing, then it's the same thing.
And I would say, in fact, which of these you want to do sort of depends a little bit on your observables and how you want to treat the sort of errors in your observables, where you're measuring luminosities for galaxies, not and your completeness and all of that kind of stuff. So one lends itself a little bit better to photometric surveys.
And I don't want to really make a big distinction between these two. This is just two ways in which, just to put down what people mean with a model. This is what they're trying to constrain. And ultimately, that's the same thing as this thing. You can write one in the other form. So now, what kind of data do people use for this? So as I said, one is the stellar mass function, right? And you can see how that relates. Right? So I can integrate, for example, let's work with this one now, over the halo mass. This is the halo mass function. It says, how many halos do I have of that mass per co-moving volume? This tells me how many galaxies of this stellar mass does each of those halos hold on average. If I integrate data of all halos, then I have the number of galaxies of that stellar mass per co-moving volume. Right? So this is how this thing is something that we know for a given cosmology. This is data, we measure that, and this is how these two are related. And that puts constraint on this thing. Okay? But this by itself, in principle, I can just take a Dirac delta function here and put all my galaxies in one halo. That should be a viable solution. But it's no longer a viable solution if I go to the next thing, which is a two-point statistic, which is the two-point correlation function of galaxies, a function of stellar mass. Now, within this framework in which galaxies live in halos, this thing, let's put me GG here for galaxy-galaxy, is going to be intimately related to the halo-halo correlation function. This describes how galaxies are clustered. Well, galaxies live in halos, so it's related to how halos are clustered. And it turns out that it's halo clustering on large scales. So if you go to scales above 5 megaparsec-ish, you're still roughly in the linear regime. This thing turns out to be, modulo uncertainties that will come later, the meta-meta correlation function. That's the dark matter correlation function. And this is in the linear regime, so this is just the Fourier transform of the linear matter power spectrum, which we know for a given cosmology. This is where your CDM structure stuff goes in, multiplied by what's called the halo bias function. And it turns out that that's something you can compute. You can also look it up in a numerical simulation. And it looks like this. Here's one. Looks something like this. So what this says is that very massive halos, more massive halos, are more strongly clustered. And, you know, I don't want to go into it, but you can quite easily understand that from discussion, random fields, and statistics. So this is extremely powerful, because what it means is that if I go and I find two different populations of galaxies, massive galaxies and low-mass galaxies, and I find that less massive galaxies are less strongly clustered than more massive galaxies, well, the less massive galaxies apparently have to live in less massive halos, because then the magnitude of my clustering goes down. So the way that clustering, a measured clustering, gives you now a handle on the halo mass in which those galaxies live is simply you do the following. You say, I'm going to take the ratio. This is something I've measured, the galaxy-galaxy correlation function. For a given cosmology, I know what my meta-meta correlation function is. On large scales, this ratio doesn't have no R dependence. It's linear. Okay? So this R dependence drops out. You get a number. And all you have to do is now look up what is the mass corresponding to that number. And that, you know, you find this mass. You go, aha, those galaxies that stellar mass apparently have to live on average in halos with that mass.
But aren't you assuming they have a one-to-one distribution?
No. Well, you know, am I ignoring scatter?
No.
Okay, this is, you know.
Okay, you assume that Xi GG is equal to Xi.
Yeah. So essentially assuming that one galaxy per halo, right? That goes in here.
No, I mean, in principle, this is just a. In principle, you do it a little more complicated, right? In principle, you really compute is the galaxy bias parameter, which is again. Right, divided by the number that's disproportional. So now you have a model here, and that thing integrated over halo mass, weighted by how many halos they have, and weighted by the halo bias. That's how you do it in reality. Right? This is just a shorthand of explaining why there's a link.
And are you assuming that your large scales here, from the small scales?
On small scales, it doesn't work, this, because this thing doesn't hold. But now, so. Just using clustering, in principle, gives you a very good handle. You should get a very good handle on sort of the average halo mass that corresponds to a given stellar mass. Okay, you can play this game. You just measure the correlation function in different stellar mass bins, and you could get this. But the problem is, it's entirely cosmology dependent. If I change my cosmology, I get a different answer. But so, ideally, that's good news. Because it means if you can come up with an additional constraint on this, we can actually do cosmology. Right? And the first sort of thing is, well, suppose I have this relation. I know how many galaxies I have of that stellar mass. That's my data. For that particular cosmology, I also know how many halos I have of a given halo mass. Those things combined basically tell me how many galaxies of that stellar mass do I have to put in my halo on average to make it work. Right? If I find that this is 10 times larger than this, apparently, to make this work, I need to put on average about 10 galaxies of that stellar mass in that halo. Right? So now I have an idea about how many I have to put in a halo. And if I know how many galaxies I put in a halo, and now I assume that the number of galaxies obeys Poisson statistics, so here comes an assumption, which is not true, but let's assume that that's true. Then I also know the number of pairs of galaxies, which for Poisson distribution is just this thing squared. So now I know how many pairs of halos or galaxies I have in a halo. And that's all I need to know. Of course, that plus an assumption about the radial profile of galaxies within the halo. So I need to make assumption about how are galaxies distributed within my halo. That's in principle something you could measure. You know, just look at galaxy groups. That now allows me to work out the correlation function on small scales within an individual halo. Because all I need to know for computing correlation functions is you count pairs of separations. Here I have all the information I need to do that. So now...
So what are the typical numbers that come out when you do this in practice for this?
Depends.
How many pairs of L star? Let's go.
Well, again, I'm doing this in a very simplistic way.
Right.
In reality, you write this down in a somewhat more complicated way. But you know.
Well, typically, you end up with one galaxy per halo at the M star regime, sorry.
Well, normally you don't talk about doing it at one M star. You talk about galaxies above a given M star, right? So above M star, right, if you go to a Milky Way halo, the answer is one. But if you go to the Coma cluster, I have 100 of them.
No, but most halos that have it. In a Milky Way like galaxy are of 10 to the 12, not like common.
That's
so
right.
If I take a big volume and count how many Milky Ways are in things like comma, the number is zero. So nothing. They exist, but they're very, very small.
That's true. Satellite fraction small, yeah. But they're on small scales, the clustering on small scales is completely dominated by those that live in halos where you have more than one.
Right.
Because it's, you know, so on small scales, it's all dominated by those that live in the most massive halos. So the point is, within this framework, you get a constraint from the, on large scales about what this thing needs to be, and on small scales, you can test whether it works. So people have done this, have tried to do cosmology that way. The problem is, you need to make two assumptions. You need to make an assumption about the radio profile. It's not too bad. And then there's this Poisson assumption. And that turns out, you know, if you look at sub-halos do not obey exactly Poisson statistics. For various reasons, they come in together in groups and that sort of stuff. And how they do not obey Poisson statistics is complicated, but this can affect things at, you know, significant level. And then there's other things that if you actually really go and want to make predictions for the correlation function, I told you what you do on large scales, linear regime. I told you what you can do on really small scales within one halo. The best data is in between. It's from 1 to about 10 megaparsec, that's where the data is exquisite already currently. It's going to get even better. That's the hard part. We have in the quasi nonlinear regime, and it's very, very hard to make reliable predictions. But this thing is quite robust from linear scale. So maybe I can use other ways. Okay, if I can get an independent handle on this, then I can do cosmology again. Right? So other ways that you can try and probe this is, for example, via the galaxy-galaxy lensing. Right, so with galaxy-galaxy lensing, right, what you have is you have a galaxy here and a halo. There's a bunch of background galaxies, and here's my observer. And these things get lensed. And in the weak lensing regime, if you're not making entire arcs, if you look now, okay, along this line here, what you see, highly magnified, highly exaggerated, is that these background galaxies get sheared. Okay, that's tangential shear. And the tangential shear you can measure in principle as a function of radius out from that galaxy, from the foreground galaxy. And it turns out that ultimately is related to not the galaxy-galaxy correlation function, but the galaxy-matter cross-correlation. It basically measures how much mass is there around the galaxy of that stellar mass. Right. And that is, mass is now probed by gravitational lensing. Okay. That's a very robust mass indicator. So in principle, this thing also gives you a handle, an independent handle, on this relation M star M halo. And if I am sufficiently flexible within my marginalization over galaxy formation physics, then only if I assume the right cosmology will those two things agree with each other. Right? So that's how you can do cosmology. Another way to do it is via satellite kinematics. Well, now you have a halo, you have a galaxy here, and you have a little satellite galaxy that are orbiting around. Right? You have a whole bunch of them. And in principle, you can measure delta V which is the velocity of the satellite along the line of sight, what I get from my spectroscopy, minus the velocity of the central. And if I do that for a large enough sample, I can construct a line of sight velocity distribution, right, for given a galaxy, a central galaxy of a given stellar mass, and measure the PDF of the delta velocities with respect to all the satellites, okay, which will look something like, you know, roughly like a Gaussian, around zero. And you measure this width here, and that satellite velocity dispersion, right, as function of stellar mass, that is set by the depth of the potential well, and it also has a handle on the mass. Okay? Now you don't use lensing, now you use kinematics to probe the halo mass. And ideally, okay, if you model this correctly, and this is sufficiently general, again, you can use this and find one cosmology which all these different probes agree.
Yes. So to zero order, you already probably get some constraints, I would presume, just from the halo mass function. So I mean, if you know the stellar mass-halo mass relation exactly, right, then you know the halo mass function exactly from the stellar mass function that you measure, right? And that would also put some constraints on it.
Yeah, but that halo mass function went in here in computing the bias, right?
Right, but I'm just saying, so even without clustering, even if you just constrain the stellar mass halo mass relation.
Like with one of those methods?
Yeah, exactly, one of those
methods. Yeah, yeah, and I could, in principle, you can just use the halo mass function. Yeah.
Those methods, I mean, you for the lensing, the stack,
yeah,
you are basically taking individual
excellent,
you know, field galaxies, right? They're not part of a bigger halo, like
correct.
So you're limiting the applicability of those methods to some part of it.
So each method has problems, right? So both this galaxy lensing, you cannot see this around an individual galaxy. You need to do this because you get two or three background sources. Okay. What you need to do is you need to take 10,000 of these galaxies in a narrow stellar mass bin. Now you have 30,000 background galaxies, and you can measure this. So you stack. Same thing here. You have one or two satellites, if you're lucky, per central. So you stack. Both methods require stacking. And that's problematic because, ideally, if the relation between stellar mass and halo mass had zero scatter, then I can stack as many centers as well, and I always stack the same halos. But if it has an appreciable scatter, and I'll argue in a minute, this has a very appreciable scatter, you're stacking big halos and small halos together. And that is something you need to model, right? But your model describes exactly what that relation is. Your model includes that scatter. This is just the first moment of that full PDF. Okay, so your model includes that scatter, and the hope is that the data allows you to constrain both the mean and the scatter, and I'll show you that we can do that. There's several tricks you can play.
Because the department losses are when that, as you say, you know, M star of M, you can have, you know, the Milky Way being the main galaxy in the halo, or the Milky Way being a satellite or a regular galaxy,
mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah.
But you lose that generality when you go here. So
well, when you stack, there's two things to do. Either you stack everything, all galaxies of given stellar mass, in which case you get a bunch of little Milky Ways stacked together, and they have slightly different halo masses, you have to stack that. And then every now and then, this is actually a satellite galaxy in the outskirts of a coma cluster, so you add this thing to it. Oh my God, no, you know. But you can model this. If I know what that is, and I make a model for the distribution of satellites, I can model this all, and people do that. You can also say, you know what, when I stack these things, I first run an isolation criteria. I'm going to make sure that my galaxy is not next to a bunch of other bright galaxies, because then most likely it's one of these. And you try to only pick centrals. Okay, so people do both. But the idea again is, the hope is that with this thing, you should, in principle, be able to model it at full level. Okay? So, these are the methods, these are the different data sets that people use. So what have we learned from this exercise? Well, one thing was already shown nicely by Mike on Monday. And that's basically, we have gotten a pretty good handle on that relation between stellar mass and halo mass. And one way that people like to plot this is to plot the ratio of stellar mass to halo mass as function of the halo mass. And then here, you can plot something similar, which is omega baryon divided by omega matter. It's a baryon fraction of the universe. So, if all the baryons in any Lagrangian volume collapse into the center of the halo and make a galaxy at 100% efficiency, you would all be lying here. What this in reality looks like, so let's put here 10 to the 12, 13, 14, 15, 11, 10, something like this. As Mike already pointed out, this is about a factor of 5. So at, in halos of 10 to the 12 solar masses, galaxy formation process for some reason is most efficient. But even there, only about 20% of the available baryons are turned into stars. 80% are somewhere. It's less efficient if you go to more massive halos. The buzzword in the galaxy formation community is that's due to AGN feedback. Then here down to 10 to the 11, we have fairly well probed it. It drops like a rock. And it's believed to be due to supernova feedback. And then we know at some point reionization becomes important, and we probably end up with only empty halos. Probably is around 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10. And what happens here is anyone's guess. It's very tempting, and many, many, many people do, you know what? Let's just extrapolate. And then they make predictions for what dwarf galaxies look like and what dwarf galaxy halos are. People do put constraints on CDM versus one dark matter with that trick. But you're extrapolating, and you should never do that.
So this isn't so much a question for Frank, but to the other the particle physicists in the audience. I mean, because we tell each other this story all the time, so it's only when Frank kind of puts it like this in front of our colleagues in particle physics that it is a little embarrassing. And so I'm just wondering, when you guys view this, because this is the stuff that you're trying to detect or think about, how does this look to you?
I mean, what are the uncertainties on this plot?
So, excellent question. 10 different methods using lensing, using satellite kinematics, using clustering, different authors, different models. They all get curves that look very, very similar. They would say factor of 2 or 3 in the absolute normalization here, 2-ish,
so
which is not bad. Right? 10 years ago, we had nothing.
Was that one of the curves that had this exponent of 1.9 or so?
Sorry?
That's for the abundance of halos, the function of mass at the low end.
Right.
It has a minus 1.9. So.
Yeah, that's the shape of the mass function.
Right. So if you actually you go back to that mass function and you ask about it, if you plot the halo mass function, it looks like this. Okay, now I plot halo mass here. I can also put stellar mass here and plot the same thing. And if I now move this thing up so that they touch somewhere, then basically the stellar mass function looks like that. It's much shallower here than the halo mass function. That's why this thing can't be linear. That's why it drops at the massive end. It also cuts off more rapidly, and that's why it does this. So this thing kind of had to come out by just looking at the abundances and you know, the idea that not all galaxies in the universe live in one halo. They're most likely scattered roughly, and a more massive halo hosts a more massive galaxy.
So the slope of this rise is related to the slope of the dark matter halo mass function relative to the slope of the galaxy stellar mass function.
Yeah. The ratio between those two slopes sets this slope.
So, again, the same question, what are the uncertainties in these slopes? So it's minus 1.9 plus minus
0. For halos, it's very small.
For halos, it's very small.
For galaxies.
So that's interesting. When we say that, it is for halos in a particular model, in a particular sort of in a cold dark matter model. The systematic uncertainties between different models is actually, I think, quite significant, particularly at that.
I think for any reasonable cosmology or even warm dark matter, we can make fairly decent predictions.
Yeah.
But the difference between the warm and the cold predictions.
If you had to put a band that would represent
the types of
models that we get these from simulation. Types of models that we're simulating right now is sort of a band.
Mm-hmm.
What is the width of that band?
It gets a bit
depends on
gets a bit broad here and then it gets very narrow here. Because here we have all the matter sigma and
uncertainties. The main issue here, this is all phenomenology, but where do you put back information on dark matter?
So ultimately,
where do you get the?
So dark matter, the entire framework of dark matter enters in my halo mass function, right? And it enters here in my correlation function. So but if you like warm dark
phenomenologically, and then you say I compare that with predictions that I have to get from somewhere. Where do you get the predictions? This is in the deep nonlinear whatever regime or something.
Uh-huh. Exactly.
So you have to compare with predictions that come from somewhere. That are from first principles in order to see that you can reproduce whatever you want to get from your phenomenological approach.
Nothing what I'm saying here holds. I mean, it's really useful to probe the very small scales that we're talking about in this conference.
No, it's not.
That really happens on
the issue is the following, that I don't think you're getting back to the issue of what fundamentally are the properties of dark matter, because it seems to be that actually you're operating phenomenology, that's great, you're going to get the phenomenological description for these models. And
that's not true. The problem is that those models that, you know, they're already ruled out, right? I mean, I could take hot dark matter, right, or very warm dark matter. This thing will now have a very, you know, very different shape. Okay. The halo mass function will have a very different cutoff, very different shapes, and I will find out that I can't get it to work.
But she's asking where we're deriving those predictions.
No, I mean, the following is but what I understood so far is that you are trying to proceed phenomenologically mm-hmm. without putting a model, but then at some point, in order to get the information that actually she said that this is what I'm interested in. Sincerely, I'm not so much interested in all this. What I would like to know is when you get back
This is where the cosmology goes in.
Yeah, so
okay, omega matter, sigma A. You're interested in sigma A?
And event.
Right? Normalization.
Right. I mean, that mass function, whatever particle is the real particle, that function is completely dependent on that.
NS, sigma A, omega matter, omega lambda, W, dark energy. All these things go in here. In principle, this is the game people are playing, right? We're going to get all this data with all these surveys and we're going to probe dark energy. If I can't make a prediction.
To get all this, as far as I understood your game, straight or this is what I'm so maybe wrong. But you're trying to get to these fundamental functions phenomenologically from observations. That's the point. That's the richness
I'm trying to introduce a framework that allows me to make predictions for what galaxies look like, the distribution of galaxies looks like. What we're measuring with DESI, with LSST, with Euclid, is distribution of galaxies. We don't make predictions for distribution of galaxies, we make predictions for dark matter. Or when we run a hydrodynamical simulation, we make predictions for things, but there's so many things that we don't know there, bearing on the physics. I want to marginalize out all the uncertainties about that galaxy formation physics. And this is a very general way in which I can map from dark matter to galaxies.
Interesting way of thinking about it would say, imagine you take, you know, a model that's very different from cold dark matter, you know, as I say, warm, very warm dark matter. You can still make this model work. So you can still explain the distribution of galaxies through this modeling, because basically it is, you take the result,
absolutely.
You know, compare the initial conditions and say, how do I match them together? And what fails there?
If I can always fit the clustering, always on large scales, all I have to do is put the galaxy in the right halo mass. But then I've made a prediction, and now I can go to my galaxy-galaxy lensing and test, do they agree?
But I think at some level, if you had a hot dark matter model, Frank, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if you had a hot dark matter model, mm-hmm. to me, it seems like you would run out of the big halos to be putting the lower luminosity galaxies in. So I don't know if there is some point where your correlation function would break.
You could make it from fragmentation, from other things.
But you have to put something else in, right? Like it would not.
I mean, with a mathematical description. It would be something that doesn't make any sense physically. But
can you rule it out through this process?
Yes. I measure the clustering on large scales. Right? My cosmology makes a prediction of what this thing looks like. Right? And now I can almost guaranteed find a solution in which I can reproduce the measured clustering on large scales of my galaxies. Okay? That implies, however, a mapping from halo mass to stellar mass.
But I guess maybe the question is, what if you...
Now I need to test whether that mapping works with lensing or separate kinematics.
I mean, that's an ansatz, though, right? I don't think you can...
Well, but that's what Julio is asking, I think, right? I mean, if you have a very hot dark matter model, you don't form things in halos, you fragment out of something else. So this is dependent on things forming in halos, right?
Yeah. But fragments of halos, so, you know.
No, but I mean, you just have a very smooth thing and you just fragment actual gas out of, you know, galaxies out of gas.
If you're starting to make okay, one underlying assumption is it's a halo base.
Yes,
so
exactly.
Galaxies form in halos.
Yes.
If you're willing to let go of that,
then
this doesn't hold.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
That's
so there are basically as many halos as there are galaxies to begin with. So,
no, I can put 20 galaxies in a halo.
Well.
But that will show up on small scales as a strong clustering. And if I don't see that strong clustering, I can rule that model out.
Fair enough. Okay.
So one question is also how accurate this technique is.
Right, so I'll get there. Because there's one big problem that I haven't mentioned yet. Right.
So you start explaining the uncertainties on that plot. So you start explaining the uncertainties on that
plot. So uncertainties on this plot. I mean, I think you know, they're getting better and they're shrinking. And you know, overall, I think, you know, this is... 15 years ago when I started this, we didn't have any plot like this. And now all these methods agree to a factor of two. Okay. Well, the different methods. And you know, people are working hard to improve that. Something where they agree even better, and that's quite amazing, is this is just the average relation between stellar mass and halo mass. But what is the scatter? You can plot as function of halo mass the scatter in stellar mass, normally in indexes, log m, sigma log m. That's about 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. And that looks like this. And almost all studies agree that at least here, the massive end of the halos, it's only about 0.15 to 0.2 dex.
That's the,
that's the scatter.
The centrals, right?
So that's the centrals. Yes, yes. So what that is if I plot log halo mass, and I plot the stellar mass of the central galaxy in a halo of that mass, that has a relation that looks something like this. That's why you get, again, that thing. It's broken. And what I'm saying is this scatter here in this direction is only 0.2 dex. It's quite amazing that it's that small. And we have very good handle on it. And I can explain how you get that handle, basically, right? So if you see this, so it seems to be good in that maybe it gets a little bit larger here, but over this range, it's all the same. But it's the same in that direction. But if I now look at galaxies of given stellar mass, at the bright end, at the massive end, this gets very broad, right? Because my slope gets very shallow. So if I pick all galaxies of a given stellar mass, massive galaxies, and I look at their clustering, if I increase my scatter, I start to mix halos of a wide range of masses. And if I start increasing the range of masses, the average bias drops like a rock. Because I only always have way more low mass halos and massive halos. So if I increase the scatter, if I have too much scatter, I can't get high bias. The only way to get high bias is put things in massive halos, and all of them have to be in massive halos, otherwise I mix it out and I smear it out. That's why we have such a good handle on it. If we increase this scatter, we can't explain the observed clustering of the most strongly clustered galaxies, which are the brightest galaxies. At the low end here, low 10 to the 11, again, hugely uncertain. I think this is very important for a lot of work that people are doing in this field, and in terms of, does it go like this, is it flattened off?
And maybe it's worth pointing out that part of the difficulty is that the bias becomes very constant,
right.
So there's just no way...
So that trick doesn't work. But there are other ways in which you can do it. With satellite kinematics, you can probe a little bit further down.
So the uncertainty that you mentioned for the mean factor of 2 is larger than the scatter.
Then the uncertainty in the scatter.
No, the uncertainty in the mean is larger than the scatter.
Yeah, everyone comes out with this scatter, but then, yeah, I can see where your question is going. Yeah, I don't know. So that's one thing we've learned. Another thing we've learned is you can play this game at different redshifts. Okay. Now, the data quickly runs out of steam if you push this away. But some people are very brave and push it all the way to redshift 10 somehow. And what you can find is you can make this plot out of different redshifts. And all the redshifts that you do, like 2, 3, 4, 5, looks very, very similar. This peak barely moves. Some people claim it moves a little bit to the left. And there's uncertainties, quite large uncertainties. But everyone seems to agree that it's a very good approximation. This thing doesn't really move, which is really interesting for understanding galaxy formation.
Yeah, which, means they, which means that when they evolve, they move around this.
Yes. Another way to look at it is if you plot redshift here and halo mass here, you basically have a narrow band in halo mass where all the action is. That's where stars form. So if you now plot the mass accretion history of a halo, very massive halo, it starts out, has very little star formation, then it reaches this band of about 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12 solar masses. That's where it's doing all its star formation. And then it goes above and apparently it quenches. And it goes here. And the low mass halos are this. And that's where low mass halos are all relatively young. And massive halos are already old. It all makes sense. And it's a very simple way to think of galaxy formation. It's oversimplified, but that's what this basically tells you. So now let's all spoil this again, because there is one big problem with this entire framework, and that is related to this here. So what I wrote there is that the clustering of halos depends on halo mass. That's true, but it's not the entire story. What we came to realize, starting in 2005, is that actually the halo bias is a function of halo mass, and the formation diagram of the halo, and the concentration of the halo, and the spin parameter of the halo, and the shape of the halo, and, you know, probably the day of the week. So this is what's called halo assembly bias. And this is a party pooper. Because suppose I have two populations of galaxies, say red and blue, and red galaxies are more strongly clustered than blue galaxies, and in the old framework, red galaxies are more strongly clustered than blue galaxies. The only explanation is red galaxies have to live in more massive halos. But now I can say, no, maybe red galaxies live in halos of the same mass, but they have different formation times, or different concentrations, or different spin parameters. So now, clustering, this beautiful idea no longer gives you a unique handle on halo mass. It gives you a unique handle on a very nonlinear combination of all these things. And that makes everything way more complicated.
But gives you a good handle on the average, I would say. It just doesn't allow you to go into
Well, not even that necessarily, because, for example, if you actually look at what that bias looks like with the halos, a function of mass, right? So that's, again, this relation. And now you plot it for the quartile that forms the earliest looks like this, and the quartile that forms the latest looks like this, and this is huge. At the low mass end, where you have very little mass dependence, you have a huge dependence on formation time. So it might actually be dominant. So it's actually...
At the low mass end, but at the high mass end.
At a very high mass end, yeah. But at the high mass end, for example, concentration dependence, or whatever, it's people are still trying to characterizing. So one thing to do is just parameterize all these dependencies, and now include that and integrate over all the probability functions. So all these parameters becomes immensely complicated. We're still not giving up. I mean, we still hope that, you know, there's a few parameters that are probably not that important. And we hope that by combining all these different metrics, we can still play this game. But if not, then we have a serious problem, because how are we ever going to map all this immense data we're going to get on galaxy clustering? And we're going to get immense data sets. Even in a linear regime, you may run into problems.
I was actually thinking about the kinematics. So it's hard to do. So for something like DESI or some big spectroscopic survey, is there any actual hope that so you won't be able to do this for most galaxies transverse, but I mean, for just the redshifts, mm-hmm. Is the precision in the optical for these redshifts going to ever be good enough that we can hope to do this? Or how can we do satellite kinematics for a large sample of galaxies? Because, I mean, there's a local volume and then you're done.
No. A bit slow, right? All you do is line of sight velocities, right?
Right. But are the redshifts good enough that you want to get precision?
You have 12 kilometers per second.
That's enough.
15 kilometers per second resolution is slow.
If you have emission lines, this you can see. Yeah. If it doesn't have emission lines, that's what it's called.
Slowness, the velocity error on the redshift is about 15 kilometers per second.
Right, but isn't your hope to kind of, I mean, I understand that in general we can do this, but isn't the hope to kind of do this really hyper-precise?
Really? With what?
Just to actually make hyper-precise measurements, in which case...
You don't need hyper-precise measurements because you're going to throw statistics at it. Right? You're gonna probe this PDF of this thing with thousands and thousands and thousands of them. So you get a very accurately measured PDF. And as long as this width is 2 or 3 times larger than that uncertainty in your redshift error, you can measure it extremely well.
And DESI is like the ELG, right? Because the ELG sample in DESI is not the main.
I haven't thought about how accurate those is. And slow, I'm currently doing this at Sloan. I mean, I've done this in the past.
The spectral resolution is a little bit higher than Sloan.
That's right. So the individually.
What's the R?
I thought it's R 5,000.
5,000.
In the red.
Compared to 2,000.
So that's pretty good.
That's pretty good. And then, I mean, so at the moment with Sloan, you can get exquisitely good constraints down to galaxies of about 10 to the 9 solar masses.
Do the stellar masses. For background, those things.
So in reality, what you have, right, is you the way we do this with satellite kinematics, you run an isolation criterion, you try to find things that don't have a very big galaxy nearby, and then all the other galaxies in your cylinder are called satellites, but some of them are not satellites, they don't live in the same halo, they're just line-of-sight projections, they're called interlopers. Now, in the ideal world, what you will find is this delta V, right, so here is zero. In the ideal world, your true satellites do this, and your interlopers are just a random velocity. In reality, the interlopers do this, because interlopers that you find are typically just in the outskirts of the galaxy, and they're actually falling in towards the halo. So they have a complicated velocity distribution, but the good news is the velocities at which they're falling in also hold information about the mass to which they're falling in. So this is actually useful information.
How are you figuring out the infalling interlopers, though? Like, how are you discriminating?
You don't. So in mocks, you can test this. You see how contaminated you are. And what you do is you work out what are the optimal selection criteria for the cylinder sizes to pick. Basically, what you do is you make your cylinder very long so that you get somehow a baseline here. And then what we do is we sort of say, okay, we subtract this signal. And that's interlopers. That means we leave a bunch of interlopers that I'm not correcting for, but the tests on mock show they don't bias your signal. And I understand why that is for the reason I just told you. Basically, they're infalling towards the same mass, and they're therefore a good mass proxy. So that's a problem. The bigger problem is things like, actually the biggest problem, freaking fiber collisions. So you can't put two fibers together, you're going to miss galaxy, and every now and then you miss the central, and then you pick a satellite to be a central, and then you screw. So you have to be smart about how you correct for fiber collisions.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you don't have to do it for every system. Like, you can, you know, there's enough, the galaxy sample is big enough that you can actually pre-select. Like, so where, I mean, given that you just need to get this to...
Just almost correct for one little problem. If you would say the ones where I know I had a fiber collision, I'm just going to throw them out. What you don't do is you're going to throw out preferentially the ones where you have a larger than average number of satellites.
No.
And it's going to bias you again.
I guess what I was thinking was, you know, where you have sort of photometric completeness. You could always follow up, right, in some systems where you have...
Yeah, but no one's going to follow up Sloan to fill up the fiber collided gap.
No. But the point is, you have some systems that you can make a cleaner measurement as opposed to doing... obviously you can't throw out things to specifically remove bias tracers, but...
Because what we do now, basically, is sort of, you know for each galaxy whether it was fiber collided or not, and then we upweight that galaxy. We say, okay, there really should have been probably two galaxies here, and we use tricks like that, and we've tested it, and it works really well, but if you don't do it, and most people who have done satellite kinematics in the past have not done it, in fact, no one has done it, we find that that causes significant bias. But all these probes have problems, right? Satellite kinematics, same thing. The galaxy-galaxy lensing has issues.
So, I guess like in a broader context, what's the future of this? I mean, it would seem that, you know, you can come up with consistency checks that we're not in a crazy cosmology, but it's unlikely this will turn into a precision measure of, you know, cosmological parameters or things like that. So, this will learn about galaxy formation modeling in lambda CPM, yes. Right? Yeah. More than cosmology itself.
Yeah. I think that's a very good point. I think, depending on the day of the week, I get very pessimistic about doing cosmology with this approach, mainly because of this thing. But if we can still get constraints for given cosmology, but what is the galaxy-halo connection? And that puts constraints on galaxy formation.
But don't we need something like really precise to interpret, you know, BAO signals and Euclid and all this stuff? Is that?
Yeah. So
you don't seem so usually optimistic.
Yeah, no, well, you know, I mean, a lot of the way out, most people believe is the way out, is to say, forget nonlinear scales. We're not going to look at any data below 5 megaparsecs. And there, in the linear scale, it should be linear, and whatever this parameter is, this factor is, I don't care. I don't work with the amplitude. I'm going to look for my BAO feature in it. That shouldn't depend on it. There's a second order effect where, you know, differential biases can cause problems there. But so DES, they had this 3x2 cosmology survey. They threw away all the data on linear scales below, I think it was 3 megaparsecs or something. I mean, that's a lot of data. And that's the data where, you know, your correlation function is measured most accurately, and you just throw it away. That's one way to do it. If you want to do cosmology, maybe that's the only way to do it. But the hope is that you can actually develop a mechanism that we don't have to throw away 90% of the data.
But so once you've done that, then you can never say that dark matter isn't cold.
I don't think this is going to do much about dark matter cold or warm. We already know that on scales we'll be measuring clustering. I know, yeah. It's a long meeting.
Yeah,
I had to step in.
I think this is just to interpret whether, you know, the BAO features.
But for dark energy, this is the way that we need to do things.
What are you going to be testing with this? If you just don't go to a small scales where you can, you have all these complications. What is it you are testing?
At the moment, there is tension in these parameters, especially omega matter, sigma 8, Hubble parameter.
Yeah, because there are the degeneracies, but you're not.
No, the degeneracies. There's tension. If you use this stuff at the CMB and the BAO at high redshift versus anything that probes low redshift, many of these things that probe low redshift find tension. They want lower sigma 8, lower omega matter, different Hubble parameter.
Wait, could you actually say something about the Hubble constant from this?
This is not easily. I haven't thought about how you do
that. So you're going to be using this to test other essential, so a structure formation as a test of cosmology, early
universe. Yeah. So one thing that people have suggested that may solve this tension is to add neutrinos. That will change the power law slope a little bit, and it might help. So it can probe, actually, interesting
scale. It's still possible to have dark, what we call dark radiation, right? There is room for dark radiation, really.
But dark radiation doesn't do anything here.
Dark radiation not changes age.
So, unmeasured tension, this is one way to probe that tension and to sort of try and marginalize out all the uncertainties.
Actually what you're later is the growth of structure. So D plus of A, and everything that encodes D plus of A can be tested.
Right. So Richard, right? When we measure the clustering, not in 3D space. We measure it in redshift space. And we get redshift space distortion. Right? You must have heard of that. And these redshift distortions, for example, are extremely sensitive to this combination sigma 8 and the linear growth rate. People do these tests, and there's tension.
Even more obscure or less popular things, like, for example, the cosmological principle. Can you say if you go to homogeneity and isotropy, if you, because this is an assumption, of course, we always rely on that, but at some point it could be tested, and large-scale structure, you assume it would be one of the ways in which you could test that. Can you test something like that?
I don't think you need this formula
larger
for
scale
that.
And isotropy.
You know, I'm looking on such large scales.
No, for example, there were this, you remember, you were not here, I think, for this. We had a talk, somebody who is always, well, you know, he's very clever. Is Subir Sarkar.
Mm-hmm.
He has this tendency of trying to say what things could be wrong, actually, in the way in which we born. And what he was saying is that actually by integrating the velocity with respect to objects that are outside spheres of larger and larger radius, at some point you get that actually that doesn't lead to necessarily to homogeneity when you go to larger and larger scales. That is that is related to a structure directly. So that's why I'm saying...
It's related to structure, but I don't think you need to understand the mapping between galaxies and halos to do that.
You don't?
Well, unless, you know, unless galaxies map to halos differently on the left side of the universe and the right side of the universe.
I don't know.
Well, if that's the case, I'm going to be a botanist or something.
Yeah, this group nature is not as unkind to us. So well, let's thank Frank again.
I'm not sure if this is so, but if you do not assume homogeneity and isotropy, these are not exactly the parameters that you need for cosmology. You have more.
Yes.
For example, some degree of inhomogeneity or some degree of departure from whatever or
it's definitely the case that like non-Gaussianity can be probed in large scale structure. And so like the effective
right.
field theory of large scale structure
is the same
kind of
thing, non-Gaussianity as the cosmological cosmological principle, not the cosmological principle.
No, they're not different.
They're not,
it's
not
exactly
the
very
same,
things.
But I think it is the case that once you get to sufficient volumes of galaxies, and the challenge is like in the Sloan volume, like you can see that, you know, it's not all homogeneous, so you do have to get to big volumes at every redshift in order to test those things. But I do think that once you get to those volumes,
because
they are testable.
There is this issue, for example, in elementary particles, we have this thing that actually field theory doesn't work. Our theories of particle physics are based on field theory. It wouldn't be without the CPT invariance, you wouldn't have a good field theory. But still, you can parametrize CPT invariance and try to get phenomenologically limits on that. There is nothing that prevents you. So if you would have, for example, a failure of the cosmological principle, which is one of the principles, right? You can always parametrize different ways in which it can be distorted. And I haven't seen limits on those potential distortions coming from larger scale structures.
Should be the one that does that the best, though.
Right? There are pretty good constraints on
non-homogeneity. On structure, like for example, Subir has this paper that actually in which he measures this our velocity. So we are moving with respect to the CMB, right? Our local group 600 kilometers per second or so. But as you put more and more and more, if you will get to whatever the great attractor is, you get to the great attractor and you incorporate it, you should see that our velocity, the velocity of the sphere that is engloving, incorporating,
should go to zero.
Including us, with us at the center. You should be able to see that actually you move at smaller and smaller velocities. This at some point at some intermediate scale doesn't work.
Well, it's a hard measurement because in order to measure the peculiar velocity, you need to know the distance,
you
and we don't know distance.
You cannot anymore talk about velocities. This is just general relativity at those scales already.
Ultimately, it's the
but
same scale.
Case,
ultimately,
in any case, whatever no?
I think that was a topic of interest, 20 years ago, I think it's been solved.
There is no solution. There is more and more data. There is this kind of things are never solved. They can be better and better.
It's a good question.
The fundamental problem is distance.
There is no way of solving a cosmological principle.
It's a good question what the current constraints are from SDSS. That's our largest local sample. That is going to be supplanted by DESI, and I guess...
but we know Sloan is a lousy thing to test that, because Sloan is dominated by the Great Wall.
Yeah, but I mean...
It's clearly, there's a lot of...
Yeah,
we clearly haven't reached
a
representative volume.
It's okay. Like, I mean, so I know that this has been... I mean, I agree with Julio. This was a huge deal. Like, in the sort of late 90s, like, you know, and so I think that that was because the, you know, but that was before the galaxy register surveys were huge, and I just don't know what the current limits are from the galaxy.
But in the 80s, they were not trying to test homogeneity.
What I meant was solved is the fact that, you know, the peculiar motion of the local group was not understood in terms of the local large scale structure. Then, now it is. You can actually take the latest, especially the H1, you know, all-sky surveys, and you map things to how to, I'm making up the number, but 10 megaparsecs or 20 megaparsecs, you start seeing conversions. In other words, the large-scale section we see is enough to accelerate the local group over the edge of the universe to 600 kilometers. I don't think that's an issue anymore.
That
was an issue because you entered out of here and you were missing.
I mentioned the approach to isotropy if you go to higher, if you integrate the mass. It's not my data, it's not my interpretation. This was the stock that there was here. It was not recorded though because it was at an odd time. And there was a long discussion, but I can get the paper because this was published. But the issue is if you can get something like this, for example, this weird ways of parameterizing, this might be really extremely interesting. Besides getting to this other more traditional ways of parameterizing.
Well, my approach is, you know, I'm not going to consider wacko theories until I can prove that this one doesn't. And at the moment, this doesn't even work. Okay? At the moment, we have tension here.
Once you assume a cosmology, which includes the cosmological principle in this case, you learn about galaxy formation. How is it that baryons cluster together and do whatever they have to do to form?
But if you do only the very large scale structure, then you don't really learn exactly that, right?
Yeah, but that's a different approach to this. I think it has much to do with that. And that actually people are doing that. They recognize that the CMB in the search for non-Gaussianity and all those are very high order corrections is very limited because it's a 2D and you can't go beyond that. And the surface of Lascaux is so thin that you really are seeing just one flash of the universe in 2D. In 3D though, that's different, right? So if you go to the higher level of velocity correlations, in clustering, then you can start seeing the growth not of density in very different regimes, and that is a sort of general
in the 21 centimeter too. Like so I think that the, you know, there's a lot of meat there in terms of exploiting, you know, looking for kind of all sorts of.
But if this approach works, but not at the small scales, okay. But it works at large enough scales, that might be extremely
well. I think it works extremely well for what I.
Way better than it should, actually.
Yeah. In other words, with a very simple relation between halo and galaxy stellar mass, you can explain a lot. Right? So that.
You pick the current cosmology, and you just say, I know how many halos I have, you rank order the halos by mass, you rank order the galaxy mass,
and then you don't need all these fancy statistics. The fancy statistics only works when you know what you're doing, because otherwise fancy statistics may lead you to things that make absolutely no sense.
I think that the statistics are justified by
good tool when you know what you're doing, because otherwise.
That's true, and
now that it's even things that
start out so fancy. They started out more simply, but I think one of the things is that now the redshift surveys, like Frank is worried about these fiber collisions, because as the surveys get better and better, if you're not properly that's just in a specific survey where you're getting the redshift or the velocity from a fiber spectrum. So you have to put a fiber on a galaxy on the sky, and if two galaxies are close together, you either have to come back to that part of the sky.
You mean to collect
this clustering information.
Fiber collision.
Because there's a minimum distance at which you can place the fibers apart, or they they physically hit each other.
You have to choose one of the galaxies that leads to a very sparse and awkward sampling in some cases.
Well, you can sample one and then the other.
But you know, it's here, you don't have one.
You have to go back twice.
You cannot do them both.
Expense.
The galaxies don't change that much in the time in which you're observing.
No, they could go back. Sometimes they don't go back.
SESSI goes back.
Anyway, well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So tomorrow we have a Robert.